Swift and the book stuff, Ezekiel. Have you ever gone into the, where it talks about the wheels? I think it's about the
Well, we have discussed that in various Bible studies. That the wheels, of course, were flying saucers, as we call them today. They were spacecraft. And the book of Ezekiel is a little hard in its translation, because when they translated in English, they didn't know what they were talking about. In other words, they translated it, but they didn't comprehend the fact that what he was talking about were moving, pulsing craft, and that they had people in them and so forth. They kind of thought they were creatures instead, and because they moved. But it actually was a description of the same kind of spacecraft that was described by Enoch, and also in the Apocalypse of Paul, kind that we see today when we focus on one of them, and sometimes we do. We have, I haven't been paying much attention lately because we haven't had very many clear nights. We've had lots of fog and material, and so I haven't looked for any flying craft because we haven't been using the scope. But if you note over here where he talks about the fact that he looked and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire enfolding itself, and brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof was a color of amber in the midst of the fire. Now, this whirlwind is not the proper word. It says in a whirling thing, a circling object, a round object, a circling whirling object came out. See, this is what the passage is, a circling whirling object. And of course, it had a radiance, an emanation of light. And it said that even though it was circular, why, it had facets to it. The upper part of it was a sort of a cubicle-like tower upon the top. And also there were emblems on it. He talks about the fact that that there were people. He said that when they went forward, everyone went straight forward, whithersoever the spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. In other words, they moved in formation. And he said these living creatures were like burning coals of fire. I beheld them, and lo, behold, one wheel was upon the earth, and one of them stood still. In other words, one of them had landed when it said one wheel was upon the earth. And he said, the appearance of these wheels and their work was like the color of beryl. They had likeness as though there was a wheel in the middle of a wheel. In other words, they were circular. They had layers of machinery. When he looked at them, why, one of them was standing still on the earth. Some people thought that one of the wheels was in the earth, the other wheels going around the sky. It wasn't talking about that at all. It was talking actually about the fact that he saw one of these sitting on the ground, and he looked at it, and it was a wheel within a wheel. Those that have looked at saucers through our Questar have noticed that there's concentric circles, and that one moves one direction, the other moves another direction, and they're moving at fairly, sometimes at higher velocities than other times. When they're moving slow, sometimes you can even see the segments in them move. And this is what they saw at that time. And, well, some have a light around them, some seem to be illuminated, some seem to be reflecting light, and some seem to be able to turn it off. So this is what you have, when he beholds it, behold, when the living creatures go into the wheels, and it says, the wisdom of the spirit was, why, thither did they go, thither they went. And he says, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. Well, the living creatures were people, ministry spirits, angels, and so forth. And when they went into the wheel, why, the wheels were lifted up over the earth. In other words, when the drivers got in, well, then they took off. They circled around. That's all he's trying to say. And he says, and the spirit of the living creatures must have made them go. In other words, they were just like a chariot or anything else. Why, they had to be driven. They had to be operated. And he says that their wings were straight. In other words, it was a great circular ledge. It wasn't as though the wings were shaped like the wings of a bird. In other words, these creatures had overlapping flaming surface. And he said he heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters. Well, you hear a jet go by and it roars. A high-velocity airplane cutting through the atmosphere, it roars. And craft moving at supersonic speeds have a great tendency to roar. And so he heard the sound. It says their wings like that of many waters, and there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads when they stood, and they let down their wings. In other words, whenever they came down to land, well, they heard the roar coming in from behind them, and the roar that he hears is the same thing you'll get out of supersonic aircraft, or you'll get out of anything traveling at higher speed. Even the old propeller planes used to make quite a bit of noise. However, these are moving at supersonic speed. Of course, we know they use electromagnetic flows of force. And so when they came down, they sat down and landed. Well, his curiosity got all beyond him. He couldn't stand anymore, and he came up close to watch. They opened a door up in it, and you'll note over here in the 22nd chapter, or the 23rd chapter, and he says, and they took a throne out of it, and the appearance, well, was though it were cut out of a sapphire stone, and the likeness of the throne had upon it the appearance of a man. I saw the color of this radiant, fiery-like amber around it, and he said, I beheld that from his loins upward he was radiant, and I saw from his loins downward, and that he was radiant, had the appearance even as though he were shimmering with fire from the brightness. As the appearance of the bow that's in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the abundance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. So he well realized that this was the kind of glory, and that this was deity. And when I heard it, I fell upon my face. I heard a voice speak. It says, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak to thee. If you come over to the book of Revelation, you'll note in the book of Revelation that this is not unlike the experience when John is on the Isle of Patmos for the name of the Lord. The Jews had exiled him out there. And it says that he heard a great trumpet sound, and he heard the words, I am Alpha and Omega, the Lord God Almighty. And it says that when this happened, that he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day, and he heard this sound, and when he beheld, lo, he sees one standing before him, like unto the Son of Man, or like unto man embodying the glory of the embodiment of God. This word, translated Son of Man, means God embodied in the flesh. And he said, I saw it clothed with a garment. He says, I saw that the radiant emanation was light, radiant white in glory. And from his eyes it was glowing with a flame of fire. And the radiance around his feet as though it burned with a furnace. And his voice was like the sound of many waters. It had so much authority. And so when he talks about this, again, he sees the radiance. Now, in this another point here in the book of Revelation, and that's when he hears the voice speak to him and say, come in hither. And he steps through the door in space and enters into the plane of spirit. This is in the fourth chapter of the book of Revelation. And after this, lo, I beheld a door was opened in the heavens, and a voice spake unto me, and it said, come in hither, and I'll show thee the things that shall be hereafter. Translated, come up hither, but this preposition has no area of direction. It's come in hither, step through into this plane, and he did. And so he said, when he entered in, he saw immediately, it was in the spirit, and he said, I beheld a throne which was set in the heavens, and one sat on the throne. And he said that as he looked at it, it was like jasper, and there was a rainbow round about the throne, and out of it came a radiant emanation like green mist or chlorophyll, which is a symbol of photosynthesis and light from light. But the most important thing is that he saw this rainbow round the throne, saw one sat on the throne, and the dimension of spirit. You go back here to Ezekiel, and when Ezekiel saw him take a throne out from this flying craft, which was a great circular ship with its wheels within its wheels, and he said that the appearance was like unto the cloud in the day of rain, was like the rainbow. So this again is a graphic duplication of witness concerning the administration of the throne of the Most High, whether he carried it with him on a spacecraft, or whether John, when he stepped into the dimension of spirit, looked upon it was still the same characteristic around about the throne. So we know that he had beheld deity riding in one of the master craft or chariots of the Most High. We'll go back to the book of Deuteronomy, when God came over Mount Paran and came down to Sinai with over 10,000 of his saints to bring the law. And you'll note at that time that the light and the glory come forth from before him, and his chariot is all radiant and so forth. And then again in the book, when Abraham said that that the Lord passed by between it like the smoke of a burning furnace, the Lord passed by. Well, this is a radiant emanation. And the effulgent Shekinah glory was almost like illuminated clouds round about when the Lord passed close by to him. And he says he went by his chariot and it was like the passage of a burning furnace. Another question? Let's do something with the question. when we talk about the New Jerusalem, we're talking about a descending civilization and a culture. It's been coming down out of heaven from God like a bride prepared for her husband. But God said it's been coming down out of heaven, and it has been descending from spiritual planes to physical ones. And so from Adam to Seth to Noah to Shem to Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, and multiplying and increasing, why, this is the New Jerusalem coming down, descending out of the heavens to earth. And of course, it's the developing, building culture, the new order of the ages. Ultimately, it brings in the fullness of the kingdom. But to establish that the New Jerusalem is actually a great body of people, that it takes people to make a city, not just buildings and so forth, because this is to be discovered here in the book of Revelation. And in the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation, I saw a new order of the ages, a new order in the earth, for the first order from the heavens to the earth had passed away. And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. So you see, God talks about Israel, or his issue that ruled with him in the earth, and he said, I am married to you, O Israel. And Israel is the bride of God as a race, and the posterity of the bride are the children of the kingdom. And so the race is identified as embodied in the earth as God's bride, and in the children as they continue to emerge as the household. So you'll note here that it says that I saw this city. I heard the voice also saying, behold, the body of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and so forth. Now, you'll note if you turn over to the 21st chapter of Revelation, that speaks concerning this city. And he carried me away to a great and a high mountain. This is the kingdom. And he showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, from which it descended from God, having the glory of God, and her light was like a stone most precious. This is talking about the radiance, the aura, the great central city. It had a wall, great and high, and 12 gates. And the names written thereon were the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So this was the symbolism of the new order, was the symbolism of the New Jerusalem. And when he saw this as a great city, a great continuing living empire, why, the names on the gates are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. So the way that you get into the New Jerusalem is you're born into it. You have to be of the issue of the Most High God ruling in earth, for the city of peace of the New Jerusalem is the capital of God in the earth. And it has been multiplying, increasing, until it comes to its full, and it's made up of people. And so when it talks about the New Jerusalem, this is symbolically the great congregation eventually of the entire posterity of the kingdom. And of course, in the hour of Christ's return, why, he brings with him all the spirits of those in the past back into the plane of spirit. He raises the dead, the great and mighty hosts that make up the New Jerusalem, and they are a great living city. And of course, the great capital of God's kingdom has dimensions given to it, even in the book of Ezekiel, symbolically. It's 1,500 miles square. It has to be set down on a great continent where there is such areas of room, and the great capital city will be made up of the people. There's no need for a temple inside, because the Lord is the light thereof. And there's no. And it says here, and I saw no temple, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of the new order. So therefore, symbolically, it's a living community and a living city made up of the glorified children of the Most High. People, a lot of them are looking for a building coming down on golden chains out of the sky, all this kind of thing. This is not only rather impractical, but there's not too much to hook it on. It'd be the longest chains in all time and history and space by which they lowered it. Two or three people have had visions in the past. These visions are the result of word pictures and their imagination, maybe some dill pickles they had along with it for supper before they went to sleep. And they've seen this city coming down on these golden chains, hanging from the sun and the moon and the stars, so forth, and lowering down on the earth. And it'd be quite a job to land it at the speed we're moving. It'd be really quite a feat. And they this is the way they've interpreted it. Just like people have an idea that the marriage supper of the Lamb is a whole lot of tables spread out in the sky, floating around in a cloud, don't sit down, eat pheasant and turkey for 7 years while the tribulation goes on down here on earth and so forth. And then after the marriage supper's all over, why, everybody comes back down and hopes to run the rascals out and get their houses back and all this kind of thing. And there isn't anything to this either, because they couldn't understand the symbols, and they translate and interpret this with a literacy literal, but not realizing what was meant. Because when God returns to earth, he's not keeping you out in space somewhere. You don't stay out there. If you went to meet somebody at the station, you don't stay at the station, you come on home. And the fact remains that with his return, why, he said that he's going to gather his people to him. Well, this is his raising up of his standard, and the great capital city of the earth will be the throne center of the kingdom. And in this instance, why, he said that he, like in the days of the psalmist, he says, he prepares the table before me in the presence of mine enemies. When God is joined with his people, and the king is in his kingdom, this is the marriage supper of the Lamb. This is God and Israel united in the earth with God's throne set in the midst of Israel and he reigning upon it. And then the marriage supper of the Lamb are all the good things that God pours out in blessing, both upon his people who he promised to bless, and then upon the whole world through them. But there were many people that were not interested in any of the things of the kingdom, and they never could be brought in contact with truth until after the kingdom comes. And some of them hide. Then after the kingdom comes and the administration is closed and the kingdom is set up and the blessings are descending, then there's going to be a lot of these rascals that are going to want in now, see? And he said, you can stay out in outer darkness. You can stay in India, Africa, and all over for a while. You got some training and some coming up to get because you didn't want to come in before. Now you can stay in the outer darkness. And there's going to be a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, not down in subterranean perdition, but on the fact that they were on the outside. And the last, some of them, will be first because they were only made last by the world order, but they were first in the eyes of God because of their truth. And for instance, you wouldn't have a very hard job finding out who they'd make last if you left it up to Brown or Moss or to some of these others. But those that they want to unseat will be those in administration of power. Also in the same passages, you'll note that, or in a couple of passages over here in Revelation, it said, behold, that the kinsmen, and here they are, thousands upon thousands upon thousands, will sit with him upon his throne, or sit in the administration, and they shall rule and reign with him. Now, this is a rather significant thing, but you'll note here that in the book of Revelation where it talks about this, it says that they shall rule and reign with him upon the earth. Behold, I heard the voices of the angels, and they said, I saw the number round about the throne. And there were 10,000 times 10,000s and thousands of thousands. And blessing and honor and glory be to him that sitteth upon the throne. And now above this, you'll note that in the 9th and 10th chapters, the 5th chapter, the 9th and 10th verses, or the 5th chapter of the book of Revelation, for instance, and it says that all these people were redeemed by the Most High, by thy blood, out of every kindred. This is the kindred. This means of all the relatives of the Most High God, irrespective of their tongue, from the peoples and the nations. Now, and has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. So this is a literal reigning on the earth of the kindred. Now, the original passages in some of the earlier translations were very lucid here, because it says, and they sang a new song, thou art worthy to take the book, speaking of Christ, and because he had paid the price of resurrection and redemption, and redeemed his own, thou art worthy to open the seals thereof. For thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of the kindred. Now, all the kindred is the word, out of all the kindred. Now, to be the kindred is our relatives, out of all the relatives of God. Therefore, as such, irrespective of where we had gone and the tongues we had spoken of in our dispersion, still he gathered us and hath made us again unto our God, kings and priests, and we shall reign upon the earth. So the new order of the ages, Novus Ordo Seculorum, George Washington knew this, Benjamin Franklin knew this, most master masons of that day, before they contaminated too much the ancient lodge, understood that they were master builders, just like the Apostle Paul, no other foundation could any man lay, and that which was laid in Jesus Christ. So the kingdom was built in great symbolism, and these symbols, for instance, when they selected the pyramid for the ideal symbol of messianic building, it's because George Washington knew all about the pyramid and this being the ideal messianic symbol. They knew about the covenant God had made with Abraham and the chief cornerstone, which Peter spoke about, and all these facets. Now, when they saw America then as a new order of the ages, the symbol was the pyramid. Not literally, we're not piled up in the air 1,500 miles high, but we are still a great
symbol of a living stone, all this frame together going into a holy temple unto God. These areas of aesthetic symbolism are used throughout the scripture. God says you are a living stone. Now, if nobody's petrified, nobody's turned into stone, he says you're a living stone. In other words, you are indestructible as stone remains almost indestructible. So also, you are indestructible because you're sustained by the Spirit. You're cemented together, sealed together by the Spirit, in which the chief cornerstone caps the whole stone. And though this was rejected by men, God sets it at the corner. He seals the whole building in together with it. So note, therefore, that the concept of a Christian civilization and culture growing up in the earth, reaching out towards the destiny, was Novus Ordo Seculorum, the new order of the ages, the new heavens in the new earth. So the law of heaven makes the new order in the earth. Now, the former law of heaven, which came to earth, was contaminated by a fallen archangel. So the old heavens and the whole old earth order, and he was the prince of the powers of the air, the scripture tells us, is replaced again by a new celestial order and a new order of the ages coming down out of heaven as a bride prepared for her husband, coming forth from God, being embodied in earth where God embodied might be joined to it in the establishment of his administration. Among the deepest of the symbolistic mysteries that belong to our race, to our mystery school, these are the lore, these are the keys. I could talk for hours on symbol mystery because those symbol mysteries were given in the days of Enoch. They were given in the days of our pyramid building forebears. They were given when the temple of Zendera was built in ancient Egypt, when the signs of the zodiac, when it had been explained to Noah, like they were explained as pictorial symbols. God had formed them for symbols. Even though we build a universe from the earth alone, these symbols have this value. So the destiny, the sovereignty of a mind that would so group this that from the track of our earth, they would have these areas of significance. Now, this symbolism is woven into all kinds of things concerning our philosophy and our thinking in the ancient wisdom schools of our race. And today, our sophisticated clergy that think they know more than God, and you're superstitious if you even recognize the signs are there, they don't know anything about the signs. In fact, I'm rather ashamed of lots of Masons. I've talked to Masons who said, who'll give you the handshake and said they've traveled and they do know the difference between the Universal Pillar and Jerusalem Pillar. They can tell you the difference between a Corinthian column and a Gothic column and so forth. And after all, this is kind of superficial. You talk to them about the real mysteries, and they don't know what the universal word, the Jerusalem word, meant. They don't know what the key to this was. They do these things to pass words. They said they traveled. But you see, these were the mysteries. These were the wisdom taught, even in the secular school, of those that would serve Yahweh. And the celestial school, where the masters of the Rose Cross combined the laws of the fulcrum with spiritual law, these symbols were taught down through the days of the masters of Israel in the time of the Temple of Solomon and clear down to the days of Jesus. And the Essene company were carrying alive the true symbolism. When the Jews came in, they couldn't catch this. The Jews, they muddle up everything, and so they came in, and in order to get some mystery they understood, they had to bring in idolatry and pagan religions, and they did this back in the days of David, and they did it back to the time of Solomon. Now, remember that this is one of the reasons why that when Solomon built the temple, the king of Tyre, you see, he was already mixed up with all these pagan philosophies, and though he knew David, and David had an alliance with the king of Tyre, that they wouldn't war on one another, and they would respect the fact that they wouldn't war on one another, yet never at any time was the king of Tyre's people allowed inside the temple, because though they claimed to belong to mystery schools and try to approach through the wisdom of these mystery schools, their mystery schools had Kali and Vishnu and Brahma and all kinds of pagan symbols in them, and all kinds of truths warped by paganism. So in the days when David was building the temple, or Solomon was building the temple, these pagan priests wanted to penetrate Israel, they wanted to infiltrate it, destroy its wisdom, take over its society, so they sent Hiram Abiff. Now, Hiram Abiff was supposed to be the king of Tyre's special teacher. And Abiff is a master of an area of wisdom. It could be a master of architectural wisdom or of the application of the fulcrum or any of these things. So Hiram Abiff was Hiram, the king of Tyre's Abiff. whereas Solomon's Abyss was different from Hiram's Abyss, see? And so a lot of Masons don't even know that today. They think he was a brother because he belonged to some Asiatic lodge. But this was a strategy. They were going to try to use this temple that Solomon was building to infiltrate. And so when they got over there, they permitted the craftsmen to work on the temple. And so they said, and Hiram sent over some of his master masons and these others, and they went to work here and there on the temple. But when the temple was complete, on the outside, the priests of Israel and the host of Levi would not let these strangers come into the inside of the temple and work in the Holy of Holies and work in any of the inside. And Hiram went to King of Tyre and said, "Behold, are we not yet brethren with these men? Have we not been the friends of Solomon's father David? Yet they will not let us enter into the temple." And they wouldn't let them enter into the temple because they were pagans and they had to stay on the outside. Because even though they called themselves a part of the Mystery Lodge now, the Mystery Lodge is like the Nye Brit, only it was tied in with all kinds of pagan philosophy. And it was not the true lodge and could never be permitted in. It was not the brotherhood of Israel or of the children of God. So they had a big beef because they wanted to come in, and when the day of the dedication of the temple came, why Hiram and all the king of Tyre and his Abiff and all of them, they had to stay on on the outside. Well, Hiram Abiff, he decided that he was going to, when they poured the molten sea, when they had to take it outside, it was a big deal, and they had to let it settle. It had to go through a very special process. This was this great molten sea was poured. And they had a great tent that they poured it in before they took it into the temple. They rolled it into the temple, and when they were casting this, like they were to shout, "Hallelujah, Yahweh!" And the vibrations of their song as it went up into the tent and came down upon the metal as it cooled, put little concentric circles into the metal, and so the vibration of praise was put into the metal. Well, the first one they poured, they didn't pour it this way. The first one they poured, they had made the mold of clay, and they were pouring it, and they were so angry that they were not going to be able to get into the inside of the temple when it was built, that Hiram Abiff climbed up on a pedestal and dove into the molten metal. And he cried before he dove, "They will let me in the temple, for behold, we shall be permanently in the metal thereof, and the life of Hiram Abiff and the life of our lodge will enter into their temple." But not so. They took it out, and they wouldn't even use the same material, or the same brass and gold, and the frantics, as they called it, they set it aside, and they gathered again the metal, and they poured it, and they dedicated it to the vibrations of the cry, "Hallelujah to Yahweh." Well, now this symbolism, for instance, of the molten sea, they used to gather around the molten sea with various certain ceremonies, for instance. When the high priest entered into the Holy of Holies, and he had a little gadget called the Urim and the Thummim, and he could divine with it, and the thing turned over, see? If the answer was yes, it went one way. If it was no, it went the other way. It was almost like a cubicle that rocked over this way or that way, and almost like a coin that would turn over by itself. Well, it was a coin. It was a cube shape. So when the priest would go into the Holy of Holies and he had great questions that he wanted to know, he could find out anything before the Holy of Holies by consulting the Urim and the Thummim, asking his questions, and the order of glory was around on the inside, and it turned this thing over to get his answer, yes or no. See? So in the meantime, the priests could stand around this holy revere, and they could, which was in the molten sea, like a huge baptismal fount, actually. Only the water was in it, and they would start singing hallelujah, and the water would ripple from the vibrations of it within the temple, even as also it did. It's like it did when they molded it. And when they looked in it, the priest would behold, just like looking into a crystal ball, they would catch a glimpse of the thing that the high priest was getting his answer on. And this was a witness. And so when the high priest came out, well, he would give them the answer, and they had the witness on the outside because they had watched this. And this was one of the secrets of the that was known by the mystery schools for years. But you see, they had a battle, you know, with the King of Tyre over this deal, and they went away real angry. And the King of Tyre was never friendly after that with Israel. And of course, Tyre was eventually destroyed because it warred against Israel. And Tyre and Sidon went down with a great collapse. And of course, this was in later years after this. But the thing that's significant here, again, is that the lodges that were not of the Spirit were never acceptable by the true priests. And the Essene company, the days of Jesus, were still discerning the phonies and wouldn't let them in, even though they claimed the wisdom and the mystery, that we got both of the pillars, and they didn't. And that's why these Canaanite, Amalekite, Hittite priests were not true priests, and they couldn't get in. The Essene company were holding their services, and they were keeping these libraries and out in the caves and the hills and so forth. Here's Joseph of Arimathea, a true Essene and a true member of the Sanhedrin, but a true Israelite. He was one of the leaders of the Essene company. And of course, he was the brother of Mary and the uncle of Jesus. He had the tin mines of Cornwall and the ships that went back and forth. A great number of the Zacharias, who was the high priest at Bethlehem, who was married to Elizabeth, the cousin of Mary, he also was an Essene and a true priest. But these knew the phonies from the real, and they did their best to hold on as best they could. But the enemy knew also who they were, but in the city of David, like Bethlehem, they couldn't dare not put in a priest of the line who was at least a priest king or of the Melchizedek type of priesthood. If they had, the people would have been in disturbing revolt. But they never understood the mystery. Even though they went through rituals and tried to put on the same kind of work just today, like the average, they've even infiltrated areas of the Blue Lodge. But you go into these Jew lodges, and you go into the average Masonic lodge, and you go to the Shrine, it's the Sway Lodge. They don't know anything about the mysteries of the kingdom. They look at you blank. They don't know the wisdom that was known in the days of George Washington or Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and so forth. And these fellows knew because they came through this work. Actually, back in the early day, one of the men the demons tried to get into the mystery schools of the kingdom. Back in the days of Demon Lay was a Jew, and he came in, and they never should have let him in the lodge. And today, the junior order of the Masonic Lodge is Demon Lay. Well, it should be Demon Lay, because there's nothing wrong with the junior order in the Blue Lodge and in the Masonry. But you see, this phony deal came with this fellow was not the one to lead it. And this is another thing. You said this fellow Pike, for instance, that wrote the book Morals and Dogma. And he went out and he brought in pagan religion, and he brought in Hinduism and Buddhism, and tried to run it into the mystery school, one of the strong pillars of Israel, see? And this is today, the same thing that's wrong with the church today is what is wrong with Masonry. See, they got into Masonry first, now they've gotten into the church the same way. And they're mixing paganism and the world and everything else into it. They got a picture in tonight's paper of Eleanor Powell, one of the actresses and dancers, and they got a picture here that seems to be one of the first associate pastors of a great new church that's going to be built down in the Hollywood area on the Strip. It's going to cost $8 million to build the church. But this church is going to be a place where everybody can come in and worship God. It doesn't make a difference what their religion is or their race, or they could be a Buddhist or a Hindu or a pagan or a witch doctor. Anybody can come in just so they worship God and their friend, see. So this is a great new thing. It's going to be the greatest church. And she's dedicating her life to this wonderful image of God, see. Well, this is all foolishness. So today, why, you'll find so many of these people still don't know what it's all about. This is one of the reasons why that when some people discovered the secrets of the Illuminati, and they found out how these Jews were waging war against our republic and how they spread out in Europe and so forth, since they had already penetrated areas of Masonry, and they set up their own phony lodges as well, a lot of these people think the Jews created Masonry, and they don't know the difference between David and Solomon and the Jews, see? But Israel were non-Jewish, and the mystery school of our race was built with the great secrets of God in symbol form, that men might retain these symbols and might tell you the truth. And so this was important. All our worship in the tabernacle was in symbol. These were symbols of a work that was to be done. These were types and shadows, but of the light ahead casting its reflection back. But when they arrived at a fullness of knowledge. But Jesus said to these Jews, he says, you can't understand my speech, you can't hear my words. You can't understand what I'm saying because you can't hear it. Now he said, well, he's talking to them. Sure he was. Jesus was never intended to understand either, because they went into the household, and he was the sovereign grand master of the universe. He was AUM, the absolute top, the complete, the peaches. He filled up all the sum of all the wisdom. PHS in completion, you see. There it was, right there. And he was the fullness of all this bodily. No wonder it was that Pontius Pilate said that when he beheld the fact that he had the answer, he says, "What is truth?" Jesus answered, he says, "You're not guilty. I want to let you go." For he knew right away that he was in the presence of a master greater than he was. And he'd already traveled. He'd been in Britain. He'd gone through the Jewish University. He had been one of the representatives of Rome there as a tribune and a consulate. And so he knew immediately, because of being a white man, he studied while he was there and took advantage of traveling through the wisdom in Britain. He knew exactly the moment he saw this. The Apostle Paul was Saul of Tarsus, but he was raised in no small city of the Roman Empire. But he was actually a Basque to a degree, and we note here that as far as the Apostle Paul was concerned, he had traveled through the wisdom schools of the race. He had been a master mason, see, before even he became aware that Christ was the Messiah. He was looking forward to this thing somewhere, because he was a master mason. He says, "I, as a wise master mason, no other foundation could I lay than that which is laid in Jesus Christ." See? Now he says, "All men, upon this all men or Israelites would have to build." He says, "And whatsoever they build would be as wood, hay, or stubble, or gold, silver, precious stones. However, in the day, all men's work shall be tried by fire." And he says, if all a man's works were burned up, still he would be saved by the fire. This is the Shekinah glory of God, purging the error out of the consciousness of man, eliminating from him all the areas of his error. And if every idea, thought, and work which men did were consumed, it would be better to be consumed and have the truth than to have error mixed with truth. Whereas the concepts which are good, the works and the purposes which men dedicate their lives to as master builders, which are well, are like building a building that is synthesized out of solid masonry, out of gold, silver, precious stones, and stones that the fire can't hurt. You know, fire can't hurt a diamond, you see. The fire can't hurt gold or silver, it just refines it. But the fact remains that the fire tries to work, but it burns up the hay and the stubble. So the Apostle Paul is using two old symbols that go way, way back to the days of Enoch and Job. What he says, "Behold, men's works will be as wood or hay or stubble, gold, silver, or diamonds." This is actually what it should say. The fire will test it, but because man has built on this foundation, he still will have the error removed, and better to have everything he does negated, that he might be illuminated with the light, which is Masonic wisdom, than it would be for an individual to retain a great image of false ideas and be shut out of the light. So therefore, the one thing you can't be a part of the temple cannot ultimately be illuminated with its glory. You can't be a part of the household and not eventually have all the evil purged out, because you have been destined to conform to his own image, light of his light, glory of his glory, and those he hath called he hath already justified, and those he hath justified he will already glorify. And the glory of the Shekinah glory purges out the error, gives a perfect image to the seat of the consciousness, makes it a living stone of beauty, and seals it into the eventual temple. So the reason why we say masons are master builders, building a great living temple unto God, the great schematic of the universe, reaching from the fatherless realms outside to the embodiment physical in the earth. Thus in form and symbol these things exist, and this body becomes a tabernacle in which we dwell. But this is just an area of the mystery school of our race. And so Jesus spoke the same language. He said, "Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, to them it's not given." He says, "I speak these things in symbol and in parable, so they will hear." He says, "First thing you know, if I just spoke out and didn't cover this up in a mystery, why, they'd all understand it, and they'd join the church and ruin it." He says, "I don't want them on the inside, because they're devils. They'd always join because they'd understand the key. And they would know then what the strategy was, they'd even make it harder. But because they can't discern it, because I speak unto you a mystery, and you can understand it, they can't understand it." Now you start talking about the synthesis of spiritual things and mystery and divine energy and the miracles. All these things are synthesized together. The greatness of our sciences are only because we have gained an understanding in the applications of chemistries or of metallurgies or in the areas of applied energies or the strength of the curve and the fulcrum and the bridge and so forth. All of these things, the strength of the triangle, the places to place the angles to get greater withstanding strength, this is know-how. Nothing more nor less than know-how. Now, this is given to our race by the Spirit, and we are made masters of fulcrum. In other words, the law of the fulcrum, this is why you get the divider. This is why the old Masonic symbol was a measuring device. And also, it was called the law of the fulcrum because one of the old devices was the application of what looked like a triangular block, and over it was a lever. And then above it was the dividers for measure. But as a man can lift many, many times as much weight if he'll use the fulcrum. But you got to have brains to use the fulcrum. Niggers don't use fulcrums, you know. They might pry at someone with a stick, but they don't perceive this. But it's the science precise. So much that we understand the fulcrum and the application even of light planes, which is even a higher science, that our forebears could lift blocks of stone, move them into place. We built pyramids, 800-ton blocks of stone. We slithered them around, put them in place, so forth, because we knew how. We don't know as much today about some areas of applied science as our forefathers did before they got cluttered up with all these pagan philosophies. In other words, that one of the things that can mutate perception is to dull the sensitivity of it. And this is also true in any psychic science. For instance, you take Zuni Indians away from their Zuni tribe, and it doesn't make a difference how they develop this peculiar affinity to color, but they can blindfold a Zuni Indian and he can pick out color. He can pick out a piece of turquoise from a piece of red abalone shell or a piece of red fiber. And you know, these Indians did beautiful mosaic work, and they worked in channel silver, and the Zunis didn't just work in turquoise, they worked in all colors, black, white, red, and blue. Now, before a Zuni Indian was allowed to work at this, he had to be able to pick out colors blindfolded by feeling the vibrations with his fingertips. Now, this could have... Now, his religion was not in a true sense, it had been negated to some degree, yet they still believed in the great white spirit and all this. However, the fact was that they did have this sensitivity, and they could feel color, and they had this psychic consciousness. But when the war came along, and they went, and they found out how much money they could make at aircraft factories, the young Zunis and some of the others went to work and learned aircraft and so forth, that they could make much more money. And when they came back after the war and tried to pick color, they couldn't do it anymore. In other words, the things that they had moved in among, the vibrations they had gotten with, had surfeited to a degree this psychic sensitivity. Now, there are spiritual areas of sensitivity that we have dulled with sordid world concepts until we have lost some of the great technique, but again, this thing is restored. There are things that are hard to describe to people because people have ideas that you have to work real hard at theology, or that you have to work real hard at spiritual wisdom and mystery. And you know, they've got concepts about how preachers do this, you know. They shut themselves off in the library and they pour over the volumes and so forth, and they teachably work out a sermon and so forth. Maybe some do, but others don't, see. That'd be kind of boring. I wouldn't mind studying something, if anything at all, if I was interested in it. I wouldn't mind studying anything about these ancient secrets and so forth, but you know, you can just go thumbing through the books and you don't get them. And the thing that happens first is that you get the image perception of it before the books and the documents ever show up to prove it. This is always happens this way. And so you know the thing before you can prove it, and then the big day is when you find it, see? And we have discovered that scattered throughout all of the compendium of human knowledge, scattered throughout the archaeologist research, the anthropologist research, all these people, even those that don't know it, they're always digging up the things we need to prove what we need to know, see? But we knew it before they dug it up, but you couldn't go everywhere to dig it up. You can't do that in a lifespan, see? Yet the thing is this, God has been doing this throughout all time. He brings this thing to the cognition of his people. There's a lot of things that I know all about before I can prove it. But I don't have to prove it, I know it, because God's already showed it to me. I've seen it clearly, see? And this is an easy thing. This is the way sermons come. I don't sit around here and work hard on these sermons. I get the topic. The topic flashes my mind a week ahead of time, 2 weeks ahead of time, maybe a week ahead of time. Sometimes 5 minutes ahead of time. Sometimes I don't even have it sometimes. I wonder what I'm going to talk about. All of a sudden, big, you get an idea of the topic. And then the sermon starts to come. Every time that your mind hits the topic, in comes ideas. They all flood around. Sometimes they don't get organized sometimes to get up to speak. You see? And you don't worry about this. If you worried about it, you'd be whipped, see? If you worried about it, you'd end up without a message. Now, you can't go out. Someone says, well, how do we train preachers to do this? It's pretty hard. The first thing you got to do is training people how to receive things from God. The first thing you got to do is you got to train them to relax instead of working at it. You know, too many people are trying to work out this thing, you know, real hard. And there is a rest that remaineth to the children of God when they cease from their resting. It says they cease from their works, they enter into His. I'll show you this in the book of Hebrews, because this is a secret of the mystery of time revelation. That when it talks about this, why it's a... Some people didn't know what it was talking about. Says there's a rest remaineth from the children of God when they cease from their works and they enter into His. And in the fourth chapter of the book of Hebrews, it says, therefore, some fear lest the promise being left of entering into His rest, any of you should seem to come short of it. But unto us was the gospel preached as well as unto them. And the word of God, word preached it not profit them, not being mixed with faith in them that heard it. For we which have believed do enter into rest. As he said, I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. Now the words are not very good, because what they meant by this in ancient English and what we mean today are two different things. In other words, this rest is a understanding, inner satisfied consciousness of the things which God did, which He has finished, which are His mysteries, which are His law, which are His power. So therefore, it says that there is a rest that we, we enter into, for which we believe we enter into His rest. Now, for instance, on the seventh day, He spake in the seventh day, and God did rest on the seventh day from all of His work, but not from His living. In other words, God stopped making and synthesizing and putting things together with His hands. But He still lived. He begat or brought forth the issue Adam on the seventh day. Adam came forth out of Him as a living issue. You see, it was on the seventh day that God said, behold, now I've made all these things, and there is no Adamite to till the soil. There's no agricultural wizard around here. There is no Adamite to till the soil. So God brought forth Adam, and immediately you got agriculture. I mean, before this, you got people picking a tree. When they went by, they picked off the fruit. They were altogether not pretty smart. There's a lot of things to be said. They run their cattle over the hills and they didn't raise any crops, but they ate the cattle and got all the nourishment, you know. I think there's a whole lot to be said for a lot of cattle going around over the hills, because they grow while you sleep, and there are other kinds of farming sometimes recover. But anyhow, as far as Adam was concerned, Adam was a tiller of soil. In other words, he understood how to do this. Not that this, he raised his crops and his flocks, but remember that the Adamic race brought a knowledge of know-how which God gave them as to how to make the earth produce food abundantly. And so we multiply this pattern. Now, but the reason why I say this, now, we note that it says that, well, the word, so therefore, let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. Now, there is a rest that remaineth to the children of God when they cease from their works and enter into His. Now, the real word here is that instead of people trying, just straining for truth, they just take it. Instead of trying to, because of, whenever people are working real hard to put something together, then they're not inspired, see? Now, you know, The sermons used to be gotten, and then there was a certain amount of inspiration that went with them, because preachers used to go into their library on Saturday and lock the door, you know, and they'd start figuring out what they had to say, and they'd start an outline with a major subject and a little piece of stuff. They used to teach them this in seminary. Couldn't help this, you see. Then they laboriously were trying to build a sermon. They'd get a little of this in and that, make it homiletical, say, put this sermon together. And when you got it out, when you got it, that's what you got. You know, sometimes if they had enough stories in it, enough incidents in it, it was interesting. And sometimes they had to get in a little Tennyson and a little Emerson, or they had to get in some poetry and a little prose, and maybe some scholarship out of literature, because you had to have some body into it, you know. So this is what they've been doing for years, and this is what we get. Well, now, this is because they didn't cease from their work. They're putting their work in there, see. They want us to know what they know, see. Well, the Apostle Paul said that he might have communed with God more than they all. But he said, I'd rather say one word in my known tongue that men can understand than 10,000 in unknown tongue. Now, I'll say this. So I can, maybe I've read as many books as they all, but I would rather have proof that was important to say than to put a sermon together, and when it's put together, you might as well stay home. This is why, the thing I want you to see is that the secret to discovering truth isn't cornered. In other words, it's to receive it with ease. It's to pulse with the thought, to catch the tempo. Once you catch the theme, you've caught your knowledge, you know who you are, you know where you came from, you know that the kingdom is real and it's on earth, you know that all the wisdom of heaven is for you, that there's no secret thing that'll be hidden from you, and you can have it all, and that the more you know, the more you can do, and the more you do, the better it is. And so, therefore, you don't strive for it in the way that some people do. You press for it, you will not be satisfied because you keep on going for more, and yet you're satisfied with this way of life. Now, this is the important thing about faith. This is the important thing about thinking. We say the Apostle Paul doesn't want unhappy people. It doesn't make any difference whether they just can't seem to crack their environment in back in the early days of the church and had a lot of hostility problems. Whatsoever state you are therewith to be content. Now, he didn't mean no ambition, but not to sit around and make a martyr out of yourself and feel sorry for yourself because you didn't get the break. In other words, the Apostle Paul said, whatsoever state you are therein. Now, at the same time, never satisfied that you have attained all, because the earth, it couldn't contain all the things there are to know. In other words, if books were written about all the things that Jesus has done. Now, let's just be realistic. See, he never had a beginning, and therefore he has existed throughout all the ages. And of course, he's always been doing something. So, if books were written about all the things that Yahshua, or Jesus, or the eternal God has done, the world couldn't contain all the books if they were just put up in racks. See? Why? Because there never was a beginning. So if you went 100 trillion years and wrote every little detail in books, see, what did you do in 24 hours? Or what he's done when he put things together, or all the scissors. Well, you never stop to think of all the things God's made here, from diatomaceous earth, the little diatoms, the shells, and the designs, and the things of creation. Every one of these was a brainwave of his. If you started to think on this, on just for instance, what we know about cell life, about bacteria, about the different types of tissue, about the differences of the nucleolus and the nucleus in cells, and the areas of the different kind of cell life. Well, you can see how a biologist, with only a limited study, fills books and books and spends a life on it, and he's put the biology together of the whole universe. All these things, that's just one facet, to say nothing of all the other things that were left. Well, if you started to put those in books, you could rack them up forever, see? So, therefore, we never reach a point where we're bored because there's nothing else to learn. So, nothing. But yet, you have the capacity, being spirit of his spirit, to think every thought which is in the thought of God. Now we're down here in a rather limited environment. The earth is big enough for us at the present time, but we're pushing outside too. But the thing is that we haven't mastered all we can know to apply the fullness of divine power to the kingdom. But instead of sometimes men work so hard at it, they go up on tangents and they miss the picture. And for this cause, therefore, you reach for truth and you accept truth and you let it flow. And thus, according to where to the fact of the environment, according to the thing that you must apply yourself, according to the catalyst of the energy, thus it's applied. Now, a minister in his route and a farmer in his, but still he had to move in his own direction, and he had to fill in the necessary sustaining block for the rest of society. So one's a teacher, and one's a minister, and one's a doctor, and so forth. But all of them were vital to this. But the same dynamic must flow through them, and they're never going to feel an inner rest until they find themselves in their thinking a part of this pulsing life vitality, this mystery of God. So when we talk about the mystery of God, this mystery don't belong to anybody else but you. And you are given to know the key of the mysteries, the key of heaven. This pulses in you. This flows in you. Don't bottle it up, and don't solidify it, except as it flows into the ever-widening picture. And so this again is a part of the mystery of the wisdom school. For instance, they taught them how to receive, how to apply, how to study. Then they taught them the symbols, and these great picture symbols became the symbols that the world would not understand. And Jesus was still talking in these symbols because he willed it. But now, therefore, he says, now, as long as I stay here and the world has got their eyes on me and I'm talking to you, I have to talk to you this way. It's absolutely necessary I go away. So it's the most necessary thing is for Jesus to come. It is today. But in that day, the most important thing was for him to go. Having finished the atonement, it was necessary he go. So it's necessary I go away. If I don't go away, this wavelength of my spirit will not so activate your consciousness that you will be led into the knowledge of all truth, and all things will be brought to your remembrance. Because instead of my being in one spot talking to those just at audio frequency, my spirit omnipresent will move and pulse through all my children, and everywhere where the children of God are, they will be able to pick up the wavelength of my purpose and thought at any given time. So therefore, now unto you it's given to them, it's not given to them. So again, the greatest development then starts in with the church and with the apostles after Christ's ascension. And it's been continuing, expanding. Now when they tried to codify it up, of course, the church, when the Jews invaded the church and Babylon wanted to codify it up, and the church kind of went into the Dark Ages. And it took a spiritual renaissance to lead it back out. And it took the word without a lot of interpretation, just the word, get it back. So they copied the scriptures tediously. They got it in print. They translated back into languages. And the more they got free from priestcraft, the better off they were. And the more they got free from solidified theology that might not necessarily be true, the better off they were. But as they saw the truth, it became like the rock. It expanded, it grows. So there are many of the churches of the Reformation. They had some truth, but not all truth. Now we are moving into the end of the age, and the enemy is doing it, is trying once more with a quick attempt to stifle out truth and keep us in superstition. Push us back again. At the same time, mix us with the world. All these things which were in their symbolism. So maybe that's enough of that for a moment. But the thing that we point out to you is that you have to feel truth. You don't just make it up, and you don't work it up, and you can search a 100 volumes, but except the spirit pull out the truth from it, you could be studying error. Say, for instance, I can find truth all through these error books, because the spirit brings it to your attention. And this is the way you read the paper. You've learned to do that. You're already reading between the lines, and you even know what the fellow looks like that wrote it after you read a little of it, you know? I mean, this is discernment. So then the most important possession is the thing you know and the thing you feel. And probably knowing sonship and a divine celestial origin, a eternal existence, a physical embodiment. This physical embodiment is pretty good, you know, when you know who you are, where you came from. When you realize that you're a celestial child pulsing in here, and you know you're not so quickly overcome by physical factors when you know that you're an eternal spirit, and when you start commanding even the physical has to respond to the will of that eternal spirit. You know, this is the difference between healing synthesis. The best doctor in the world can find an awful job trying to heal somebody that's already defeated and is about to die. And there's been some people that have been shot all apart, blown all apart, still they live because they just have a great driving will that has things it wants to do, and it's synthesizing energy and it's putting it together, see? So this is the secret too, in another facet of it. Now there's a secret of directivity, because you are one with the spirit and you're resident in this body, and the power is over the darkness. You have the power to direct life and energy and vitality whithersoever you see it being synthesized with divine energy. And as you see it, so can it go. As the receiver sees it, so can it be received. Sometimes you're plucking a block because you pray for something that is constructive, and you've got a negative person that doesn't believe it, even though they say, pray for me, you know. So you throw up a block. Now, you can break through this sometimes. Sometimes there's... But the thing is that all these things are the same pattern. God synthesizes the universe and solidifies gases and particles and elements. He puts the things together, and he can keep it together, and he gave you power to keep it together. He gave you power to command even the elements. So these are things that... This is the mystery of the kingdom. Now, this is translated in part into our creative activities, our building, our chemistry, our astronomy, our science, the evidences that make us so different from they. This is what we translated. But even in doing this, we hadn't reached the apex point, because you'd be surprised how many of these things could have been done with easier synthesis than this. And before we're through, we're going to see greater things than these shall ye do. Another question?
Going back to your discussion about Hiram, the king of Tyre,
yes,
and his controversy with Solomon. I just have a hunch that Hiram, although he's a pagan, probably a devil, not a devil in the Jewish sense, but I have an idea he's a white man.
Well, let's go back again.
He was no.
Wait a moment. Now you're dealing with Cyrus and the Medo-Persians. They were Aryans, but the peoples of Tyre had blood and background fused with pre-Adamic races like title King of the Nations and so forth. Yeah. So, now Phohanok, the sons of Enoch. Yeah, well, there's a place to divide the line. Everything called Phoenician today wasn't Phoenician then. See? And they didn't know, what some history books now call Phoenicians, they didn't call themselves Phoenicians then. In other words, remember that... Phohanok, yeah. Yes, but they didn't call the Tyrrhenians Phoenicians. They didn't call the Sidonese Phoenicians. No. If this guy wasn't the pagan, if this fellow was the pagan of the Temple of Kaylee, he would have jumped into the molten sea to curse it, to get in even where Yahweh wouldn't let him in. Well, every Adamite with Israel, any Israelite could have got in. Oh, not necessarily. Persia has long been a part of the road channel of our race and migration. You see, other people came into Persia afterwards, into Baghdad too, these people, the steppe peoples from Asia came in, the Assyrians, the ancient steppe peoples, and they had been somewhat, so therefore there was mutation that took place. But the high, pure Persian originally was Aryan, say. We all came, Dolan. What happened to them? Well, they came right on down. They, oh, what them were. They were still coming down in the days of Moses. For instance, in the days of Joseph, a lot of the peoples that were, well, yes, but I mean, I'm showing that they were still there in the days of Joseph. Enoch is 5400 B.C., so they were still there. As the daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On, they were Sethites from the days of Enoch. They were Sethites from the days of Enoch that had come down from the site of ancient Jerusalem to build the city of On. They weren't Israelites that built On and the pyramids. They were Israelites as in that they were Israel, issue ruling with God. But when Joseph went down to Egypt, he was the son of Israel. See, Jacob, they were changed to Israel, and Joseph was the son of Jacob, and he goes down to Egypt, and he finds the pyramids, he finds the city of On, and he finds the high priest of the white race that go all the way back to Enoch and Job, and marries the daughter Asen of the priest of On. They were still here. Why, when Moses went out into the priests of Midian were Hyksos. This isn't the Midianites. This is priests in Midian of the Hyksos. And so when he married this princess, well, she was blue-eyed and fair-haired, not this nigger they talk about. That's all hooey. They talk about the fact that he married a nigger. He didn't marry a nigger. That's all. There's no word in the scriptures anywhere that indicates that, that Moses married a negro. He married a blue-eyed, fair-haired girl. Well, but we got... No, he wasn't an Egyptian. He was out of Egypt when he met this girl. The Egyptians were actually... Remember that he rescued this girl from the Egyptians who came to kill them, to capture them when they came down for water. Remember that this priest, king, father of the wife that Moses married, had flocks. His daughters went to the spring out in the mountains to water the flocks, and here came marauding Egyptian soldiers, and they were going to capture the girl, and it was Moses that defended them. They weren't Egyptians. Though the thing that was so amazing is when they brought this man to their father, he said, "Well, this man has spared our lives and protected us, and so forth." And here he was wearing the sin. See, this is his kufu. This is a band that comes around like this, and then it had this kufu right up on the top of it, which is like a great. It's like a golden dice that comes up that is ruled. Now, this was the sign that he was of the royal family of Egypt. And of course, you see, he'd been raised as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And when he went out of Egypt, he was the prince of Egypt. Why, he, remember that the treasure cities of Memphis, why Moses managed their building. In fact, those great treasure cities, Troas and Memphis, why he was in charge of the whole thing. And the name of Moses is on to this day. And the name they gave him as the son of Pharaoh's daughter, the name given unto Moses was Walker with the Right, and he built this great city, and the treasure cities of Pharaoh that were built by him are historic. See, thousands upon thousands of Egyptian workers under Moses, and his name and his exploits go down. Great engineers, technicians, greater knowledge. Where did he learn it? He learned it from the school of the Temple Divan. See. And then inspiration brought it to him. Well, now when he left, after killing the Egyptian, he had to leave because he had thrown, he threw this Egyptian who had been an Israelite. Remember? So then he went out into the wilderness because he knew the law for that anyone that threw an Egyptian in defense of any people of any other race would have to die. This was the law. So therefore he left. See? And but he still was riding on a white steed with a golden saddle. He still wore the kufu, see? And when he fought against these Egyptians, when these Egyptians could even have been pursuing him, for they found the Egyptians, see? This could have happened because when they saw him, they did battle with him, and he went and defended these girls that they were going to attack and take them away prisoner. But when they brought him before the father, They were bringing a prince of Egypt, and when they brought him in, he saw this prince of Egypt, and he wanted to know what they had brought unto him. They said, "Behold, this Egyptian defended us and fought off the bands of the Egyptians." So now later translations alter the story slightly than did the oldest Septuagint, or the record they had in Alexandria, but you still find it in the scriptures. So when he married a Hyksos princess daughter of the Sethites, right on down. Now remember, this was acceptable to the Most High, just as Jacob said to concerning Joseph when he first saw Ephraim and Manasseh, the two boys, after he was brought to the land. "Let my name Israel be named on these two boys." Why? Because when he married Asnath, he married the white race, and he hadn't married outside of his race. It was acceptable seed. If it had been a mongrel seed, he couldn't have blessed it and taken it in. So we absorbed the remnant of Enoch and Sethite line. There was a little strains of it gathered in here and there. Missionary activity brought it back in. A little of it in India, a little of it was found in the upper mountains of between Europe and Asia, in the upper Tibetan Basin, Taishan Mountains. We will go in tonight to the pursuit of the round table, but when St. George conquered the dragon, he rode forth to Christian villages in the mountains, white man, Christian villages, and he conquered hordes of pagan Chinese troops that wanted to exterminate the Christian villages. And they were Christian because Prester John had wandered through, and when George got over there and asked how they were Christian and how they got their message, and they said that they had been converted by the disciple John. And so that was 1036 when Genghis Khan's hordes had come, why John was still traveling around. And when George asked them, who is John? They said, well, John is the apostle. And he said unto them that Jesus said, if I will that he tarry till I come, what's that to thee? You follow me, he said to Peter. Jesus said, some of you standing here shall not taste of death till I come in my kingdom. Well, which ones? Everyone died but John. You don't have any record dating out of John. Must be still here then. There's another mystery too, but we don't get in that. It gets pretty deep in that.
Who do you think the happy people of Hunza are?
They're Greeks. Sure, when Alexander the Great was going to conquer all Asia, and he came up over the Himalayas, and he was coming down the backside of India, and they got in this canyon, and terrific rains and melting snow had swept that river through there, and they couldn't get by it. They didn't have these roads that took them years to build up around it, and so here they were caught in there. And you see, the Greek armies traveled with their women too. And so the Greek women traveled with them, and this bunch got caught in this pocket. They couldn't get out because they couldn't get ahead because of the freshet, and the snow didn't melt, and the path was behind. And they carried fruit and all these things with them, and grains and rice. This is always the Greek did. So they knew they were going to be stuck here, so they sowed it. And a terrific summer in there, terrific climate and wonderful rich soil. And the crops just grew fine. And these fellows were smart Greeks, and they built themselves nice houses of stone. They had all these things, and they decided that life had to go on. And so they stayed there, and they raised their children, and they waited for some of the Alexandrians to come back, and they didn't come back that way. He conquered that part of India, and he turned back, you see. And so they got stuck there, so they stayed there for about 5 or 6 years, and the snows were exceptionally deep. They couldn't cross the back of the Himalayas. And when they went down into India, some of them started down the track. Well, they were hostile armies now of Punjabs down there, and there wasn't, as they couldn't find any of their spies and runners, went out to try to find the armies of Alexander the Great, and this bunch had been cut off. There's about 500 or 600 of them been cut off up in there, and now these armies had already gone back to Greece, and here they were stuck up there. So they went back up there and stayed there ever since.
Why did they live so much?
Well, good night. The first place, they don't have any Jews. No, they don't have no preservatives in the food, you know, and they make, and I'll tell you something about the thing. First place, they got nothing to worry about, no taxes, see, no problems. The soil brings out fine food. The water is the best. If the place is running over with pheasants, there's game. They brought with them their own beast of burden, and they domesticated, they were domesticated naturally. They always carried, all armies of the Greeks carried chickens and these various things. Now they've got everything. They've got sheep, they've got cattle, they've got chickens, they've got all these things in there, see? They got eggs, they got milk, they have the finest of whole grains. Nobody in there told them how to polish this grain out.
Well, I wondered if they come from Jacob, you know?
No. They came from Scythians. First place, they don't even want to come out. How about that? They're happy. Hunza.
They must be near 200 years old.
Well, I don't know about that. They a lot of them 160, 65. They're terrific bowmen. But now, of course, they've got guns, and this has been added to them because they. Wandering tribesmen, and of course old Thomas went in there, you know. He went when he came over the Khyber way back years ago, and he went up into Hunza, and then they made Cinerama. One of their Cineramas where they had, one of the first ones, they had a little picture of Hunza, say. But the Hunzites didn't want these people to come in, really, because they said they were afraid that they'd bring in disease. They never had flu, never had a cold, never got sick. No disease germs in there, see?
No doctors, no police.
Well, they should have just got themselves a bunch of ammunition and said, stay out. We don't want anything in here. But this is good Israel stock. These are Scythians.
I thought they had it.
Well, I've got all kinds of records of that.